From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Bush administration appointees. Is there more emphasis on political connections than qualifications? We talk with Time Magazine White House correspondent Mike Allen, co-author of an article in this week's edition titled, How Many More Mike Browns Are Out There? Also, we talk with writer David Rakoff about his new collection of humorous essays, Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems. He's a regular contributor to This American Life. And book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews E.L. Doctorow's new novel, The March. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. An article in this week's Time magazine asked the question, are there more Michael Browns out there, more political appointees who don't have a lot of expertise in their area but are responsible for decisions that will affect our safety? The article concludes that at top positions in some vital government agencies, the Bush administration is putting connections before experience. My guest Mike Allen co-wrote this piece. He joined Time magazine this month as a White House correspondent. He previously worked for the Washington Post, where he covered the Bush White House for 4 years, then covered Capitol Hill. The Time article points out that a benign cronyism is more or less presumed, with old friends and big donors getting comfortable positions and impressive titles. But according to the article, what's going on now is different.
What my colleagues Karen Tumulty, Mark Thompson, and I looked at was if there was something different about the way the Bush administration was shaping the bureaucracy. And we actually were digging into this story before Michael Brown, the outgoing head of FEMA, came into the news. But he sort of served as an obvious case study to look at whether there were people in the government who'd been chosen more for their connections than for their competence. So often patronage jobs are people who are hidden in the bureaucracy or have a job like ambassador or something where there's only so much harm you can do. Now in a time when there's threats at home and abroad, the bureaucracy can matter. And we saw that on a grand scale down in New Orleans. We saw that it matters whether you know how to and are able to reach down into the bureaucracy and ask someone to drop diapers on the Superdome. There is a way to do that, but you have to know how to do it.
Well, let's look at some of the Bush administration appointees. Let's start with somebody at Homeland Security Department. And your article says that a well-connected White House aide with minimal experience is poised to take over what many consider the single most crucial post in ensuring that terrorists do not enter the country again. She worked briefly for Michael Chertoff as his chief of staff when he was at the Justice Department. And she just married Chertoff's current chief of staff. Her uncle is Air Force General Richard Myers. So what are some of the questions surrounding the nominee Julie Myers to head Immigration Customs Enforcement?
Well, Terry, Julie's someone who has very close professional and family ties to the administration, someone that they're very comfortable with. Now, when she went up for her confirmation hearing, senators debated whether or not she met the statutory minimum for that job of 5 years of management experience. Now, she convinced them that she did, but some of the senators expressed to me surprise that they were confronting a nominee who it was debatable or a close call whether or not they were minimally qualified. Now, I talked to Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who was one of the senators raising those questions, and she said she now is satisfied that Ms. Myers met that requirement. But the point that she made to me is Ms. Myers would not be her choice, but it's someone that the Secretary of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, is comfortable with, someone the White House is comfortable with. And so as opposed to bringing in an outsider to learn the Bush culture, this is an example of a younger person from the extended family who's being put in a big and important job.
You mentioned the importance of already knowing the Bush culture. Do you think there are times when being comfortable in the Bush culture and understanding the Bush culture is considered more important than bringing expertise in the field?
Yeah, of course, what they would tell you is that they look for both. But a very important question as they're vetting potential candidates is he a Bushy? Is she a Bushy? And by that, that's meant, is it someone who has been around either the campaign or the administration, somebody who understands the way they do things, who understands their culture of message discipline, and who understands their culture of always putting the focus spotlight on the president. Microphone hoggers, camera hoggers are not invited. And that's why in this administration, you have a lot of, even at the cabinet secretary level, people who are devoted to Bush or who have connections to this administration, but are not necessarily stars or authorities in their fields. And a notable exception would be Colin Powell, Secretary of State, and we saw what happened to him.
Let's move on to David Safavian, and he was the chief procurement officer. He was appointed in 2003. He resigned on September 16th of this year, and then shortly after that was arrested and charged with lying and obstructing a criminal investigation into Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. So what experience and qualifications did he bring to the position of chief procurement officer? And perhaps you should describe what that position actually is.
Yeah, well, they're partly responsible for purchasing decisions by the government. And the Office of Management and Budget has emphasized to me that he doesn't have that sole authority that no person does. But Clay Johnson, who, Terry, you remember him, he came to Washington with then-Governor Bush from Austin and was the director of the transition, was the first director of personnel, and so is in many ways the architect of this personnel system that you and I are describing. He hired Mr. Safavian, and he told me that he was the most qualified of the three or four people who were chosen. But certainly it was an embarrassment when last week he was arrested in connection with this case. Now, the administration makes the point that that was unrelated to his duties. But this was the first time, I think, that the Abramoff case had been visibly, publicly, specifically brought into the White House. And Clay Johnson gave a very candid account of how Mr. Safavian came to be there. And he says that Safavian mentioned before his background check that there might be an issue, that he'd had some connection to some people, as Mr. Johnson put it. Now, after the FBI check, after this went through the White House counsel's office, he was cleared. And so he did take the job. But that certainly raises a question about what the standards are. If the candidate knows that they might be questionable, it's quite amazing that they would survive that screening process.
Somebody else who you write about in your article on Bush administration cronyism is Scott Gottlieb. In July, he was named Deputy Commissioner for Medical and Scientific Affairs at the FDA. He's one of three FDA deputies. And you write about questions concerning his financial ties to the drug industry. What are those connections?
Well, because of work he'd done previously, Mr. Gottlieb had to recuse himself from dealing with issues that involved many of the major drug companies in America, which makes you question how effectively he can do his job if he has to recuse himself. I saw the letter, this long list of drug companies. And this is a case where you have the political people who are coming in, those 3,000, who clash with the career or civil service people who are there. Scientists on the FDA staff told my colleague Karen Tumulty that they felt intimidated or they felt constricted by questions that he was asking about decisions they'd made about drugs. And we got some of the emails that he had sent second-guessing decisions that they'd made, questioning either whether these questions should have come up. And anybody who gets an email from their boss second-guessing them, it certainly is going to affect what you're going to do next time. And so there's a lot of people in the FDA who say, you know, this is meddling by politicians, which is inappropriate. Now, Scott Gottlieb has said that he does stay away from decisions like that, and we had a long string of administration people phone us up to tell us how qualified he was.
Your article mentions that before he became an FDA commissioner, Gottlieb was the editor of the Forbes Gottlieb Medical Technology Investor, which was a Wall Street newsletter about medical and biotech investments.
Right. And so that's what makes the scientist question his involvement in the decisions. To them, he's a 33-year-old stock picker, not someone who's an authority in their areas. And Terry, this raises the question about people from an industry coming in and then regulating that industry. And again, this is something that Twas Ever Thus, but the FDA is an example of where this is a life and death decision, where consumers depend on the FDA to protecting them. And what you'll have critics of the administration saying is these people have been trained in industry, focused on the lobbying agenda, what that industry is after. Then they go into the administration and they go right to work, that there's not a learning curve, that people from industry know what they want to do the moment they hit the ground in the administration.
Your article also writes about inspector general positions, and these are positions that were created after Watergate, and they're supposed to be hired without regard to political affiliation. What do inspector generals do, and why did your article raise questions about those appointments?
Yeah, Terry, there are 57, 8, 9, something like that, inspectors general in the federal government, And these are some people who are the internal watchdogs in a department or agency. So someone who works, for example, in the State Department and is charged with looking for and exposing waste, fraud, abuse in that department. So it's a little like internal affairs for a police department. And these positions are even more important now that you have an administration that has the same party in power running Congress. This Congress has taken a generally passive approach to oversight of this administration. So the inspector generals can be the last check on the government. And at the higher levels, these are presidentially appointed positions, and a number of the people who have been in these positions have close family or political ties. The best known example is Janet Rehnquist, daughter of the late Chief Justice, who was the Inspector General at the Department of Health and Human Services. Henry Waxman, a Democrat of California, the chief Democrat on the Government Affairs Committee, did a study of all the AGs and that found that the ones appointed by President Bush, roughly 60% of them had Republican political connections, and roughly 25% had former audit experience, which in the statute is supposed to be the sort of deciding point, is technical expertise like that. In the Clinton administration, according to this study, those numbers were roughly reversed, that roughly 60% had audit experience, only maybe a quarter had political experience, a striking difference.
How much time does Congress actually spend in the confirmation process of the positions that we're talking about?
Well, Terry, you raise a great and timely issue, because there's a number of congressmen, there's a number of senators who've been embarrassed to have their quotes read back to them from Michael Brown's confirmation hearing when he was confirmed for a lower level post at the Federal Emergency Management Agency. He was not confirmed to be director, but he was confirmed earlier. And among the senators who were lauding praise on him was Joseph Lieberman, a Democrat of Connecticut. Now, of course, Michael Brown is the whipping boy for much of what went wrong for the federal government in Louisiana. I was surprised when Karen Hughes came up for her confirmation hearing to be one of the deputy secretaries of state in charge of all the public diplomacy and public affairs, runs a huge empire, is going to be one of the administration's most visible faces, is in the Middle East at this moment, appearing for the administration, is someone who has been a ground zero throughout the administration, can answer any question about anything that the president has done. Not one Democrat showed up at her confirmation hearing. A huge press corps showed up, and we thought it was going to be a great show. She'd been prepared for tough questioning because she knew there would be cameras there, and her theory was that that would mean that Democrats were there. She had a private meeting with Senator Biden, a Democrat of Delaware, the day before, and he actually supported her. And then the next day, I believe it was a Friday, or it was a day at least that the Senate was gone, no one was there.
My guest is Mike Allen, a White House correspondent for Time magazine. He co-wrote this week's article about cronyism in the Bush administration. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Mike Allen, a White House correspondent for Time magazine. He co-wrote the article in this week's edition about Bush administration political appointees who have strong political connections but weak qualifications for their jobs. You've been covering the White House for several years. I'm wondering about the position of Karl Rove now. Over the summer, the Valerie Plame investigation was a big story. Judith Miller is still in prison. And questions have been raised about what Karl Rove's involvement was in leaking that Valerie Plame or Valerie Wilson, her married name, was a CIA agent, and was that payback for the fact that her husband reported that the Bush administration's allegations about Saddam Hussein trying to buy yellow cake in Africa were incorrect. So how has that affected, if at all, Rove's standing and power within the Bush administration?
I'm told that this case has really taken a toll on some of the people in the White House. After 5 years, and a lot of them worked in the governor's mansion before that, the presidential campaign before that, a lot of these people are just tired, understandably. These days in the White House are 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. when nothing is going on, and longer than that when there is a crisis. And partly because of the uncertainty, partly because it's clear that there's more White House involvement than was known or described in the beginning, I'm told that is affecting people. Mr. Rose specifically says that he was not the source of Ms. Plame, Ms. Wilson's identity, but it's clear from some of the information that's come out that a reporter or two probably considered him their source. If you look at the plain language of their stories, they appear to have depended on Mr. Rove. Now, Mr. Rove's attorney has said he's been assured by the prosecutor that he's not a target of this investigation, but it is a big question mark. I know that it has not hampered Mr. Rove internally. He's as important as ever. His shop is the sort of idea cooker for the administration. They're the hub of input from all over the country. He's the network that sort of keeps track of the grassroots around the country. As you know, from the beginning, Mr. Rove's formal title has been senior advisor to the president. As you know, in this second term, he also is one of two deputy chiefs of staff. What's going to happen to the Plame case is one of the big unknowns that sort of hangs over the second term. And I think that there will be great relief when that is settled one way or the other.
In the meantime, what is Karl Rove's role in overseeing the rebuilding of New Orleans?
What's interesting about Mr. Rove is he can have the last word on anything that he wants to, but he doesn't necessarily have operational control over everything. I think there's this urban myth that he pulls the levers for absolutely everything, and there's no question that he can stop or get the ball rolling when he wants to. But there is, inside the White House specifically, a Katrina response task force, and it's headed by the other Deputy Chief of Staff, Joe Hagan, the one who frequently is with the president at the ranch when he's in Austin. And it used to be Josh Bolton, who also was a Deputy Chief of Staff. But Joe Hagan is my nominee for White House official with the most power and the least attention. Joe Hagan can decide everything in the White House, from your salary to your BlackBerry to where the president's going. And he's added Katrina to his portfolio. And the White House is putting out reports that sum up, these fat reports that they're sending to the Hill, that sum up what each department is doing in response to Katrina to show that it is a government-wide effort. So what you'll see is Mr. Rove making strategic decisions, such as he'd have a lot of input, for example, in where the president will visit, and you have other people with operational day-to-day responsibility.
The Washington Post recently had a story, has the president lost his swagger? Do you think that in any, literal way, the president has changed lately? Does he look different to you? Did he physically have a swagger that he no longer has?
This is a president whose trademark quality was certainty, that he always knew what he was going to do and stuck to it, even if people inside thought he should be adjusting course. Now you've had a succession of bad news. There have been very little positive news for this White House since the president was reelected. You had the brief euphoria about the elections in Iraq, which was no small thing. And they're very excited about the success of Roberts and how smoothly that went, partly because of White House operations. And they're discouraged because if it weren't for Katrina, all the news would be about how great things were with Roberts. But with the president now, you have someone who's having to readjust the way he does things, the way he thinks about things, the president's concession that more could have been done or different things could have been done with Katrina was very uncharacteristic of him. And a lot of my colleagues were struck by how different his tone was in the speech he gave urging Americans to conserve energy. That just has not been the Bush message. And so it's an example of how he's trying to find his footing, find a new message in the post-Katrina world. What the administration is very intent on avoiding is having the bookends of the administration be 9/11 and Katrina. That's a storyline that a lot of people in the media are sort of picking up. And the White House is intent on being sure the president is remembered for something besides that. At the moment, you have uncertainty, something you rarely saw in this White House. And that's where you see the curtailed, at the very least, swagger.
Well, Mike Allen, thank you very much for talking with us.
This was fun. Thanks, Terry.
Mike Allen is a White House correspondent for Time magazine. He co-wrote this week's article, How Many More Mike Browns Are Out There? I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, including The Great Good Book, The Bible and the Roots of Western Literature. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. From Audible.com, where you can download and listen to NPR programs like Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers. Audible.com/Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, writer David Rakoff reads from and talks about his new collection of humorous essays, Don't Get Too Comfortable. He's a regular contributor to This American Life. Also, Maureen Corrigan reviews The March, the new Civil War era novel by E.L. Doctorow, which has her thinking about New Orleans. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is writer David Rakoff. He's a regular contributor to the public radio program This American Life and to the magazines GQ and Outside. He's also an actor and has worked in theater with David and Amy Sedaris. If you pay very close attention, you'll see him briefly in the new movie Capote. Rakoff's latest collection of humorous essays is about the culture of excess. It's called Don't Get Too Comfortable, The Indignities of Coach Class, The Torments of Low Thread Count, The Never-Ending Quest for Artisanal Olive Oil, and Other First World Problems. The opening essay is about becoming an American citizen a couple of years ago. He's from Canada, but has lived in New York for many years. Here's a short reading in which he describes struggling over the 10-page-long naturalization application. He figures it should require about a day or two of work, but it took him 4 months and 1 week.
My first hang-up occurs at Part 10, Section G, Question 33. Are you a male who lived in the United States at any time between your 18th and 26th birthdays in any status except as a lawful non-immigrant? I make my living with words, and yet I cannot for the life of me begin to parse this question with its embedded double negatives and hypotheticals. How are any non-native speakers managing to become citizens, I wonder? Part of my clouded judgment is due to fear. I don't want to piss them off, and I am worried that a wrong answer will immediately feed my name into some database for a wiretap, a tax audit, or an automatic years-long misplacement of my application, some casual, gratuitous harassment that a thuggish administration might decide to visit upon someone they identified as a troublemaker. I spend an entire afternoon trying to map the grammar and come away with nothing but a headache and no idea. This is in early March. I put the form away in my drawer and forget about it. My dreams of inalienable rights failed by just one question. I put all thoughts of citizenship out of my head until one evening in July, 4 months later, when, as I'm dropping off to sleep, the clauses fall into place and the lock turns and I realize the answer is a simple no. With inordinate self-satisfaction, I soldier on. Have I ever been an habitual drunkard? I have not. A prostitute, a procurer, or a bigamist? Nuh-uh. Did I in any way aid, abet, support, work for, or claim membership in the Nazi government of Germany between March 23, 1933 and May 8, 1945? Nein. Do I understand and support the Constitution? You betcha. If the law required it, would I be willing to bear arms on behalf of the United States? Again, I stop. The same headache as before marches its little foot soldiers across my cranium. I put the application back into the drawer and return to my bed, not picking it up again until 7 days later, when I surprise myself by checking yes.
Why was that a surprise that you would check yes to that question about bearing arms?
Well, because for a variety of reasons. I was raised as a sort of a pacifist, socialist, you know, Hebrew school child. So bearing arms was... is a fairly extreme thing and very alien to my upbringing. We're also not even sort of violent or aggressive people. You know, we can't throw balls, we can't catch balls, we don't... You know, there's none of that sort of... I wasn't a hockey child, so I don't have that particular bellicose outlet. So that was a surprise. And then, of course, if you weren't born here and you become a citizen, if you're an adoptive American, that whole kind of swaggering... militaristic George Patton, that whole framing of masculinity is not something that is in your DNA. Regardless of your placement on the Kinsey scale, it's really rare. Do you know what I mean? It's just rare to sort of come here, not having been born here, and be John Wayne. You know, at most you might be Burt Lancaster, but in The Swimmer or in The Big Tent or whatever it's called, you know, but otherwise so that was a real surprise. And also, given the history of the United States and long before, you know, what's going on in Iraq and everything, I can't think of a whole lot of wars that I would willingly take up arms for. I say at the beginning of the chapter, well, I say later on in the chapter that there are a whole lot of conflicts that I could imagine taking up arms for. You know, the situation in Darfur strikes me as being fairly cut and dry, and perhaps I'm being naive, but it seems like one should just go in there with armaments and, you know, stop the Janjaweed. Or, you know, the minute the words ethnic cleansing were coming out of former Yugoslavia, it struck me as being an opportune time to, you know, to twig to that historical precedent of what happens in Europe when they say ethnic cleansing and really do something about it.
Why did you want to become an American citizen? You're from Canada.
I'm from Canada, and I have lived in New York essentially since I was 17 years old. So that's 6.5 years. No, it's been, you know, a long time. I'm now pushing 41. And so all my formative years have really been spent here in New York. And it got to the point where I had this civic life, which was pretty rich. You know, I paid taxes, I went on demonstrations, I was, if not directly politically involved, politically informed and engaged and everything. And there was this one central lack in my life, and that was the right to vote. And things were becoming very dire, in my opinion. I really needed to vote. For myself, I have no illusions of the fact that, like, yet another gay New York Jewish liberal who works in the media is really going to tip the balance in any way. But for myself, it was just I couldn't go on in this sort of shadow status. I also have to admit, I stopped feeling safe here, despite the fact that I am, you know, white, well-spoken, well-educated. I make a living. I pay taxes. I own property. It had stopped. I no longer had this kind of implicit faith in the ultimate fairness of the administration that is sitting. And I stopped feeling safe here. And I didn't want to be put out of my home.
So does it feel much different to be a citizen now?
Does it feel different? A little bit. It feels, I confess to having some ambivalence about having done it still. And this apparently, from my very anecdotal and informal poll, turns out to be a very common feeling among adoptive Americans, at least people who are adoptively American late. Because, you know, the reputation of the country has changed over the last few years. And so I do feel ambivalent about it. I feel that it has, on the other hand, completely legitimized and ratified the most important reason I did it and the most important relationship of my life, which is my relationship to New York City, which I love with a kind of embarrassing depth. This is the thing that actually makes me the typical American immigrant, is the way that I feel about New York City. It's been a state of affairs for immigrants to this city for a century or more. You know, I just can't get over how much I love New York City.
My guest is writer David Rakoff. He's a regular contributor to This American Life. His new collection of humorous essays is called Don't Get Too Comfortable. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is writer David Rakoff. He's a contributor to This American Life. He has a new collection of essays called Don't Get Too Comfortable. One of your essays is about your experiences going to two cosmetic surgeons in Beverly Hills. And you have them each give you an assessment of the work that they think should be done on your face.
Yes.
New definition of masochism to do that. Why did you do this?
Well, I did it. Initially, I did it for for an assignment. But of course, I don't take any assignment that I don't immediately leap at. I mean, the thought of when it was suggested to me, I was at dinner with my editor, and I virtually leapt across the table at the prospect of doing something like this. It seemed fascinating. There is a masochistic quality to it that I reacted to. I would enjoy that. You know, I don't know, I want to bother it like a loose tooth or something. It just seemed fascinating. And also it seemed on the cusp of something. We are right down the rabbit hole in terms of this aesthetic tyranny, which seems to be getting worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, to the point where I often think, you know, about 20 years ago, or maybe it's longer, I can't do the math right now, Jill Clayburgh was a bankable movie star. She was, you know, the star of movies. A lovely-looking woman. Jill Clayburgh couldn't get work now as Quasimodo. I mean, it's just, you know, it's just what's happened is, you know, the ugly best friend is now Julia Roberts because she's over 37. It's unbelievable to me. Imogene Coca, huge star. Giulietta Masina, a huge star. You couldn't get work as Giulietta Masina today. You know, waiting tables, you couldn't get work as Giulietta Masina. So it seemed like we're in this place where You know, I'm an okay-looking guy, but as I say in the book, you know, my face has never been my calling card. At the same time, I'm very lucky. It's not a punchline. You know, it's not the worst face in the world. People don't look at me one way or another. Whatever ways I've had to manifest have been through other, you know, tricks. Like a fancy vocabulary or something. But, you know, so I went to these guys because I thought, mistakenly, as it turns out, I thought these guys were the Pharisees. You know, I essentially thought that these were the guys pushing the agenda. And on some level, they must be the guys pushing the agenda because they normalize, you know, procedures that, let's be honest, cut you open, shove a tube in, suck the fat out, break your bones, move stuff around. I mean, it's really brutal, brutal stuff. I don't have cable, but apparently, is there a channel that's either just the surgery channel or it's the plastic surgery channel? I can't remember which. But, you know, a lot of people have become inured to these processes. They know what it is. But, you know, I watched videotapes of liposuction. It's unbelievably violent. So I went to these guys thinking, you are the people who are perpetrating on this. This onto an unwitting public. You're the guys who have made it a cardinal sin for Jill Clayburgh to exist. Of course, that wasn't the case. These guys are extremely conservative in their approach. And there's a reason, actually, that these two guys are the two top surgeons in Beverly Hills for what it is they do, you know.
So what do they say to you looking at... I mean, you're a writer and an actor. So what do they say to you looking at your face?
Well, they were very reluctant to do anything. Like, I kept on telling them about my thick skin and that I didn't mind and that it was for a story and that they should just have at me. And they still wouldn't really do it. One of them mentioned as how they might straighten out the tip of my nose. It apparently it droops down to an unhealthy degree. It's, you know, it's your typical usurer's nose from an anti-Semitic cartoon kind of thing, with a little less character, actually. And they thought that they might get rid of a furrow between my eyebrows, you know, and clean up some of the bags under my eyes. But really, other than that, it was just sort of a freshening up. It was like tuning up a car, I guess, although I don't drive a car. So what I'm assuming is like a car tune-up. But they never said, you know, we'll cut out this, we'll give you, you know, we'll give you a huge square jaw, we'll cap your teeth, we'll give you a new nose, we'll, you know, change your eye color, you know, all manner of things, we'll give you a hair transplant. I was really hoping for that kind of overhaul, at least theoretically. And it just didn't happen. They wouldn't do it.
Why is it in your writing that, on the whole, you've chosen subjects that are not the most life and death subjects of our age?
You mean why am I not going to war zones?
Yeah. Do you ever feel like you should be doing this as a writer? You should be. You know, instead of going to the cosmetic surgeon or, you know, writing about seeing the show Puppetry of the Penis. Or, you know,
yeah.
Writing about your affection for Martha Stewart, yeah, that you should be going into war zones or, you know, covering like the major stories of our day or, you know, like personal tragedies or, you know, just like,
you mean my personal tragedies or other people's personal
either,
tragedies?
Either.
Well, a few things occur to me. You know, the fact that I am shallow as a puddle frequently worries me enormously. And the hope is, well, two things. The hope is that somehow the pieces touch on something deeper than their surface subjects. You know, the Puppetry of the Penis piece is meant to be the sort of deeper meditation on the way a city recovers, mostly New York City after 9/11. And, you know, it's done in the most oblique, subtle, perhaps not detectable to the reader kind of way. But also because of this sort of humorous sensibility that I have, I mean, I can be deadly serious, and I'm deadly serious about many things, but those are generally private things. I wouldn't want to write about someone else's personal tragedy. I'm uncomfortable with that kind of reporting. I'm uncomfortable with prying in that way. I'm not dogged about other people's information in that way. I can't do it. I've tried. But my feeling is, other than elected politicians, no one owes you their story. And I think you need, to be a really good reporter, you need to feel that people owe you their story. I've never been that guy. Mm-hmm. And that might be having grown up in Canada. I can't do it. I can't, you know, I could no sooner go up to somebody who had just lost everything and say, how do you feel? I mean, I can guess how they feel. They feel lousy. You know, I can't ask that sort of second question when they essentially tell me to drop dead. I can't do it. I'm not brave in that way.
The last time we spoke in 2001, you said something that I thought was very interesting and also very funny, which was that you'd carry around a Xanax with you and probably like never use it, but just having it there calmed you down because you knew that you had an option. If things got really bad, you had the chance.
I could just check out.
Right. You could take this anti-anxiety pill or give it to somebody else who needed even more.
Exactly.
And so do you still carry it around as almost a talisman?
Oh, absolutely. It's still there in my little... in the container that I keep my breath mints in. My breath mints I take with, you know, almost religious regularity. But the Xanax, I don't take so much. But its presence is tremendously helpful. As I get older, certain little phobias get more pronounced. You know, my claustrophobia is worse than it used to be. Sometimes my agoraphobia kicks in. And you never want to be the person in the stalled subway car who is just losing it. You know, you don't want to be that embarrassing example of, oh my God, you guys, we're all going to die. You know, I've certainly felt like I've wanted to be that person. I don't want to be the person, because then eventually, you know something, the subway starts to move and you emerge into the light and you're just there having soiled yourself and you have to get home. You know, so it's just, so, you know, as a sort of a counterphobic measure, I keep the Xanax on my person. But I have to say, I now ride in the front car of the subway.
Why?
Because I need to look out the front window. I just need to know that we're moving forward. I need to be near the driver to know that he doesn't, you know, that he exists or she exists. It's just one of these little, you know, counterphobic things. Because here's the thing, I don't not take the subway. That's the main thing. I won't, if I can walk, I'll walk. But that's just New York. I just like to walk. But, you know, I can't let it stop my life. You know, I was a very phobic little kid. Faggy phobic. Oh, it was a lot of fun. And it was my father who said, you know, you can let these things rule your life. And you mustn't. And so I sort of understood early on, feel the fear and do it anyway. And I was even talking to one of my nephews recently, because we were in Buffalo over Labor Day weekend. We were going up to the old City Hall, which is a beautiful building. It's got this beautiful observatory at the top. And I said, I'll go to the elevator with you and I'll come up with you, but I'm not going on the balcony. He said, why? And I said, don't you know that I'm scared of everything? I'm scared of everything, but I do it anyway. But I won't go on an outdoor balcony 25 feet up in the air. But yes, I do keep the Xanax. And I have to say, I give away a lot of Xanax.
Well, you've given me a new aphorism to live by now. Feel the fear and do it anyway. I like that.
Oh, you know, I think it might be a self-help book that's called that.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, David Rakoff, it was great to talk with you again. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
David Rakoff's new collection of humorous essays is called Don't Get Too Comfortable. Coming up, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews E.L. Doctorow's new Civil War-era novel, The March. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
E.L. Doctorow is known for his best-selling novels like Ragtime and The Book of Daniel that focus on crucial moments in American history. His new novel, The March, continues that tradition by taking readers back to the Civil War. Book critic Maureen Corrigan has a review.
It's impossible to read E.L. Doctorow's new novel, The March, and not to think about New Orleans. Practically every page of this novel is saturated with descriptions of an army of the dispossessed roiling through the South, covered in mud and slime, peopled by the lost and innocent, as well as by the vultures who prey upon them. Doctorow's specific subject here is Sherman's march during the Civil War, but his overarching subject is always the idea of America writ large, its democratic promise, its nightmare possibilities. Doctorow writes like a visionary poet whose gaze encompasses American history, past, present, and to come. And so it's easy for me to believe that even as he was imagining these scenes from the Civil War, he was also foretelling the New Orleans disaster, when once again the Democratic crowd would dissolve into a free-floating mass. As befits a story about Bedlam, there's not so much a linear plot in the march as there are fragmented images pushing and shoving their way to a foregone conclusion. The novel opens in 1864, after the burning of Atlanta, when General William Tecumseh Sherman led the Union Army through Georgia and up into the Carolinas, fighting and pillaging, as well as accumulating an auxiliary civilian army of exiles, newly freed blacks and fugitive whites. Doctorow plucks a few individual characters out from this throng and sketchily tells their intersecting stories. Among others, there's an, of course, beautiful ex-slave girl named Pearl, who passes for white, a chilly army doctor who becomes expert at battlefield amputations, a steely southern belle or two, a decent Irishman named Walsh, who joins the army as a paid substitute for a wealthy New Yorker, and General Sherman himself, who's periodically depicted as mentally unhinged. Even Lincoln has a cameo. But the American multitude is really Doctorow's main character here, and his writing is most electric in the pages and pages and pages of this novel that he devotes to describing the swarm. Sometimes those descriptions are majestic, as when Sherman's forces make their entrance into the novel in a cloud of dust. Other times, Doctorow describes the crowd as horrific, as in this snippet where General Sherman wanders through the night and watches Columbia, South Carolina, go up in smoke. His troops were everywhere drunk. Some stood in front of burning houses, cheering. Others lurched along, arms linked, looking to Sherman like a mockery of the soldierly bond. It was all in hideous accord, the urban inferno and the moral dismantlement of his army. These veterans of so many campaigns, who had marched with him hundreds of miles, fought stoutly with nothing less than honor. They were not soldiers now. They were demons laughing at the sight of entire families standing stunned in the street while their houses burned. Whether or not you'll think The March is an instant American classic will depend on whether or not you think a novel can be sustained solely on the power of its language. In a recent, and as one would expect, very smart essay in Slate, writer Francine Prose argues just that, that style is all in the literary novel, and plot is, as she says, the least of it. Certainly it's the least of it in The March, where Doctorow's elegant meditations roll on, swallowing up plot, character, and all other fictional elements that stand in their path. But with all due respect to Prose's pronouncement, I think some great writers, like Doctorow, really produce their best books when their soaring style is held in check by the mundane demands of telling a story. Doctorow can generate pages of biblical riffs, but sometimes that's all he produces, as in his last novel, City of God, which, along with a lot of other reviewers, I found incomprehensible. When his meditations are tethered to a strong historical plot line, as in Ragtime and the incomparable Book of Daniel, there's no other American novelist who so unironically steps into Walt Whitman's bardic boots, retelling our national stories in the larger contexts of myth, anthem, and tragedy. The March offers amazing descriptive and contemplative passages about the Civil War, but ultimately it doesn't go anywhere. It's stalled in the accumulated profundities of its own language.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the new memoir, Leave Me Alone, I'm Reading. She reviewed The March by E.L. Doctorow. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Schurock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Delacorte Press, publisher of Robert's Ridge, a story of courage and sacrifice on Taker Gar Mountain, Afghanistan, by Malcolm McPherson. From Endless Pools, the treadmill for swimmers, installed indoors or out. DVD or video available at 877-ENDLESS or endlesspool.com. And from Scholastic, presenting the children's book Inkspell by Cornelia Funke, at scholastic.com/Cornelia Funke. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with New York Times reporter Dexter Filkins about his latest stay in Iraq, covering the drafting of the Constitution and the insurgency. He won the George Polk Award for War Reporting earlier this year. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.